First of all, when I stop talking, remind yourself right now that when I stop talking, you should put on gloves for the rest of it. Also, there is nothing magic about 30 minutes. So if you have a timer set, jot down what time you actually started with. It's actually better to go a little longer than 30 minutes. You just need to know how many minutes. So write down the beginning time in case my speech makes it go over, and then you can still figure out how many minutes you're waiting. Okay, now we're doing a new technique today that we haven't done, and it is called spectrophotometry. As you see by the ending of the word, metry, it is a measurement, just like calorimetry was, measurement of something. And it involves light, which is why photo is in there. Spectrophotometry is an indirect way of figuring out what the solute concentration of some solution is, which is a valuable thing to know for various reasons. Well, we've talked about solutions quite a bit already, right? A solution is a mixture made up of solvent and solute. And we've talked about what concentration is. It's the strength of the solution, more or less, right? There's different ways that you can define concentration, but the one that we talked about in here is molar. That's the units, right? What are the units of molar? I mean, how is molar defined? That's right. Moles of what? On top. Moles of solute per liter of solution. Overall solution. The reason I'm mentioning this again is I said just a little bit ago that spectrophotometry is an indirect way of measuring that. Think about what it would take for a direct measurement. To directly measure concentration, you'd have to get in there and count the number of particles so that you know how many moles there are of solute, right? Keeping in mind that a mole is 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd power. So that would take you many lifetimes to do that, even if you could get in there and count them. And then you would divide by the number of liters of solution you're working with. So it's... We don't do it directly. That's impossible. We need an indirect way. And that's what spectrophotometry allows us to do. Based on the technique is based on the fact that some particle types are able to absorb visible light. Visible light, which we'll talk more about once we get to photosynthesis, is in the form of little energy packets called photons. You can think of a photon as a particle of light, even though it's not, it doesn't have any mass. It's not like an atom. Okay, that's what a photon is. A little packet of light energy. And the reason things look different colors to us is that there are different wavelengths of light. So wavelength corresponds to color. And like I said, some particles absorb photons. Well, that's one possibility. When a photon of light encounters an object, there's three major possibilities. One is that it will just pass through that material. In other words, transmission. Just go through it, like when light comes through a clear window. Another possibility is that it will reflect off, it'll bounce off in some other direction. In both of those cases, the photon still exists. The third major possibility, though, is that the photon gets absorbed by that substance. And when a photon gets absorbed, it no longer exists. It eliminates the photon, but you should already know from the first law of thermodynamics that it doesn't eliminate the energy, right? Energy isn't created or destroyed. Therefore, the energy that was carried by the photon gets delivered to the thing that absorbs it. That's not really important to today's discussion, but those are the three possibilities. And spectrophotometry is based on the fact that certain particles can absorb photons. And these particles, that these substances that absorb photons, we call them pigments. And that's why they look certain colors to us, which I'll explain more about when we get to photosynthesis. But if you were, go ahead and open up your little box that has your spectrophotometer in it, just so you can look at it. It's a pretty compact device. They used to be much bigger. Notice that there is a square hole in the device, a little well. That's where your samples go, but you are not pouring anything into that square hole. It's a square hole because it's made to fit a square-shaped tube, which is a special tube specifically for spectrophotometry. Those tubes are called cuvettes. Now, this is why I want you to put gloves on once I shut up, because you don't want to touch these cuvettes with your bare hands. Not because you'll die. Well, you will die eventually, but not because it's dangerous to touch these, but because you don't want to have any fingerprints on these, because that can block the light and give you bad results. So put gloves on before you pick up the cuvettes. When you do pick the cuvettes up, though, as they have a square profile, so there's four ways you could fit them into a square hole, obviously, but there's only one proper way to do it, because if you get the direction wrong, the light will go through it differently. And that's why they're marked with a little triangular notch on one face that you match up with the triangular shape on the instrument itself. And by the way, there are also lids right next to this box of cuvettes, which are what you should label. Don't put a label on the side for the same reason. You don't want to block any light. All right, anyway, that's what your sample goes into the cuvette, and then the cuvette goes into the instrument. But if you were to take the instrument's panel off and look under the hood, you would see that at one end there is a lamp, and the lamp is emitting white light. White is the combination of all colors. So there's all different wavelengths of light mixed together. That's why it looks white to us. After that, in between the lamp and the sample well, you would have a prism. And because of the angles a prism has, when white light strikes it, you have bending of light rays, which is called refraction. And here is where the wavelength matters. The wavelength corresponds to color perception in us. But, you know, some of those photons are at certain wavelengths, others are at other wavelengths. And when white light, which is a combination of all these wavelengths, strikes a prism, there's going to be refraction, bending of the rays, and they're going to go off in other directions. But how much bending depends on what the wavelength is. And this is why entering white light turns into a spread of different colors, right? Just like the cover of Dark Side of the Moon. The reason this is important is because if you have a particle that does absorb light, there is one particular wavelength of light, one color, so to speak, that it absorbs better than anything else. And that's the color of light you therefore want to use so that you have as much sensitivity in your instrument as possible. So you need to set up your instrument to have the correct color or wavelength of light make it to the sample. If you imagine turning this prism, you would still have the spread of colors, but turning it would allow you to choose just one color that would go straight through, and the others would just go off to the edge and not be used. You see what I'm saying there? Okay. So there is one specific wavelength that actually gets to the sample where your cuvette is. And at the far end, after the well, you have a collector plate that is sensitive to light. When photons strike that collector plate, it creates an electrical current in the instrument, and that's what causes the readout. That's what it's detecting. Okay? So the reason this works is there's going to be some light that actually goes all the way through. But if you set this up so that you're giving the sample the correct color of light for that particular substance that you know it absorbs well at, then the more solute particles you have, the more of that substance you have, the more of the light coming in will be blocked, and the less will actually make it to the plate. You see that? This is how we can indirectly measure concentration. But you can't use this instrument for an absolute measurement. An absolute measurement stands on its own. This is a comparative measurement device, meaning that you can only get meaningful results if you compare it to some reference or standard. And that's why you have to set the instrument up first with a reference that you can then compare your other samples to. And that reference is called a blank. It's a special cuvette that you make up for the purpose of calibrating the instrument. All right, now a blank is just let me start over here. You also, if you're going to use a spectrophotometer, need to know what kind of solution you have. You don't know what the concentration is. That's why you're using the instrument. But you have to at least know what kind of solute you have. So it wouldn't be useful for just a completely unknown sample. You have to know, for instance, that this is the solute. Right? Well, if you want to make a blank to calibrate the instrument, you have your samples and you know what the contents are. You just don't know how much of the content. You know what the solute is, you know what the solvent is, just not how much. So you would make up a blank that would have everything your samples have in it, the same solvent, in other words, but no solute at all. That's why it's called a blank. Now, that means you don't have any particles in there that are known to absorb light that you're sending to the well. Is that clear? And so when you put that blank in, light's going to go through it because there's no solute particles to absorb it. But it's never actually going to be true that 100% of this light goes through. Some of it's going to glance off and not reach the collector, right? But since you made a blank specifically like your samples but with no solute particles, that means however much light does get through the blank, you're going to tell the instrument, consider this to be 100% of the light. In other words, none gets absorbed. That would be defined as zero absorbance. Absorbance is really what you're measuring as the output of the instrument. So setting up the blank and figuring out how much light goes through that allows you to set the instrument to zero absorbance. Calibrating the instrument, in other words, is also known as zeroing it. It's kind of like hitting the tear on a scale. You have to set the zero, and then you compare everything else to that. Now, after you have the instrument zeroed, imagine putting in one of your samples. You know what kind of solution it is, you just don't know how many solute particles are there. But if it has any solute particles of the correct type that you've set the instrument up for, then not as much light is going to get through compared to the blank, right? And that will be, since you've set the zero, that will be displayed as a positive value of absorbance, some number. And the greater the concentration of solute particles, the more light gets absorbed and doesn't make it through. So it'll get a higher and higher absorbance value as the reading. Does that all make sense?
The greater solute equals higher reading.
Yeah, the more solute particles that are in this well, the more photons will be absorbed by those particles, and therefore less light is transmitted, which is the same thing as saying more light is absorbed. The instrument will read out, though, in absorbance, and the higher the value, the more solute particles there are. Now, absorbance is not concentration. Absorbance is the direct output of the instrument, but you can actually calculate a concentration based on the absorbance, and the manual has you do this. It's easy math to do. Your absorbance value is your direct, your raw data, but you then use that to calculate concentration. Okay? That's all really just background information for how to use the spectrophotometer. That doesn't really explain the experiment. So now I want to do that. This, by the way, is the third and final experiment that you write up as a report. But don't even start writing it until you get feedback for the second one, which hasn't even due yet, right? Okay. So wait till I grade those before you write this up. Take good notes today so you don't forget what you've done. Let's talk about the experiment itself, though. You are investigating enzyme activity in this experiment, meaning how well an enzyme does its job. Well, you already know that enzymes are catalysts. So the job of any given enzyme is to speed up a reaction. Enzyme activity is a numerical way to say how well the enzyme is doing its job. And so you can express enzyme activity in terms of how much a reaction proceeds in a given amount of time under a certain condition. If an enzyme is not working at all, then substrate, which is the reactant, doesn't get turned into product, right? If in the same amount of time a lot of substrate gets turned into a lot of product, then you know in that condition the enzyme is working very well, because that's the job, is to speed the reaction up. So that's enzyme activity in general. Now, the author of the manual just made up this story, this whole story about BIMCO or whatever it is nonsense. It's just a fairy tale to hopefully hold your interest. But I prefer to just give you the truth about what's happening here. So I'm going to tell you what's actually happening. We are investigating what we call in plant enzyme in the story is an enzyme called lactase. You can tell that's an enzyme by its name, right? Well, this is one of those enzymes that are named for the substrate that the enzyme works with. Because the normal substrate for the enzyme lactase is the sugar called lactose. Now, what is lactose? It's a sugar. You know that from the OSE ending. What does lact mean? Means what? Well, not the word lact. What is lactation? Milk production. Lact means milk. Lactose means milk sugar. It's found in milk. In terms of how big a carbohydrate it is a disaccharide. Just like sucrose is, table sugar, except that it's It's not the same two monosaccharides hooked together to make lactose as it is for sucrose. They're fellow disaccharides, though. For lactose, the two constituent monosaccharides that make it up are galactose, which is a hexose, 6-carbon sugar, and the other one is glucose, which is also a hexose, right? So glucose and galactose actually have the same chemical formula, but they're different monosaccharides because of the different arrangements of the atoms. Well, to make lactose, you just hook together one galactose and one glucose with what kind of bond? A glycosidic linkage, exactly. That would produce lactose. Well, the job of the enzyme lactase is to undo that. Just like you can build a disaccharide, you can also break it down. And so if you break that glycosidic linkage in lactose, then you produce both galactose and glucose. It's the hydrolysis of lactose. That's the specific reaction that lactase speeds up. And that's what you're investigating. Now, you're using a spectrophotometer to investigate that. You could do this in either of two basic ways. Because if the reaction is happening, then over time, lactose is disappearing, right? Because it's turning into these two. And over that same amount of time, these two products are building up. So you could assess the activity of the enzyme, lactase, either by measuring how rapidly lactose disappears. You could measure disappearance of substrate, in other words. Or you could measure the rate at which either product appears. It's the same thing, right? You're getting at the same number two different ways. Does that make sense to you? There's a problem here, though. To use a spectrophotometer to measure concentration, you have to have a substance, a solute particle, that absorbs photons. If it doesn't absorb photons, the spectrophotometer is not the instrument for you. It doesn't do you any good if the light just passes through it. It has to absorb it. And the problem is that lactose doesn't absorb photons in the range of the instrument. They just go right through it. Invisible, in a sense. The same is true for galactose and glucose. They're all invisible to the instrument. So you can't, in this reaction, figure out the activity either way, either by disappearance of substrate, because you can't detect substrate, or appearance of product, because you can't detect product either. This is why this story was invented by the author. Because we care about how quickly this reaction happens. We just can't use a spectrophotometer to do it. Well, enzymes are specific, but not necessarily uniquely specific. Specific means that an enzyme works on only a certain shaped thing as the substrate. And there are some enzymes that will work on one thing and one thing only. But there are some enzymes that will work on multiple different kinds of substrates as long as they fit in well enough. So the multiple substrates have to be similar enough to each other to both be able to either one to be able to be used with the same enzyme. You see what I'm saying there? Okay, so we can't use lactose as the substrate and get any meaningful results spectrophotometrically. We therefore have to use a surrogate or replacement substrate. And that surrogate substrate is ONPG. ONPG is short for ortho-nitrophenyl beta-dextrogalactopyranoside. which is not something I expect you to remember, but that's why we call it ONPG. Much easier to say. It, meaning ONPG, is very similar to lactose, which is why it can also fit in the active site of lactase. Part of the similarity is that just like lactose, ONPG is built out of two things that are hooked together. The two things that make up ONPG, well, one of them is galactose. Just like one of the things of lactose is galactose. All right? But the other thing making up ONPG is not glucose. Instead, it's O-nitrophenol. And so ONPG is both of those two things hooked together. And just like you can split a lactose into glucose and galactose, you can split an ONPG into galactose and O-nitrophenol. This is what we're using so that we can use the spectrophotometer. But ONPG is just as invisible to the spectrophotometer as lactose is. So we still, even using this other substrate, can't detect the disappearance of substrate. And of course we can't use galactose, the appearance of galactose, because I've already told you that's invisible. O-nitrophenol, though, is the one that is detectable. So that's why we can do this. O-nitrophenol absorbs light, which is why to our eyes it makes the solution that it's in look yellow. So you just with your naked eyes, you can make a qualitative assessment of how much O-nitrophenol is there, because it'll look more and more yellow the more there is. That's just a qualitative assessment. It's not putting a number to it. A quantitative assessment, though, you can get by using a spectrophotometer. Spectrophotometer is able to tell much better than your eyes. Now you might have two, what you say are to your eyes, equally yellow solutions, but they might be drastically different in their actual concentrations. The spectrophotometer can figure that out for you. So you are assessing the enzyme activity for lactase by measuring spectrophotometrically the appearance of O-nitrophenol coming from ONPG, the surrogate substrate. Is all of this clear? Okay, well, the use of the spectrophotometer is pretty straightforward. Just follow that little card's instructions to the letter when you do this. This requires the computers. You have to hook the spectrophotometer up to the computer, so I need to unlock this, which I will as soon as I shut up. Remember to put your gloves on. But when you do the zeroing, that's really the part that takes longest on using the instrument, because you have to wait on it to heat up and stuff. You'll see what I mean. But make sure you're using the right cuvette, the right sample for your blank. You put it into a cuvette. That gets you your zero. Once you have that zero, then it goes quickly, because you can just take that blank out and put cuvettes in with your other samples. Just put each one in, wait a few seconds, and then write down the number. That's your data. Once you have those raw data, then you can follow the instructions for how to convert that into concentration numbers. All right? So once you get the computers up and running, I'll come around and make sure you're doing everything correctly. But that's it. And so as soon as you get your gloves on, make a calculation of how many minutes when you actually stop the reaction, so that in the math part where you convert into it's on pages 113 for one experiment and page 110. Notice that you get absorbance values, that's the A. You then do the math described in the paragraph above, to get the column after the absorbance, which is micrometers of O-nitrophenol produced in 30 minutes. Well, it's not necessarily 30 minutes. It's however long you're running yours, okay? Because the reason that's important is that the one you really care about is the final column, which is per minute. So whatever you get in the penultimate column, next to last column, you divide that by the number of minutes, not necessarily by 30, to get it into per minute values. Ask me if that's not clear to you, but that's why you need to keep track of the number of minutes. Okay, I'll unlock it and you can proceed.